So, welcome to the first lecture. So, this is the course is Mathematical Foundations of Data Science. So, the word mathematical is important because, you know, data science and sort of buzzwords like that have very many meanings, right? Some of them, of course, have to do with data. But this course, on the face of it, will have something to do with data. We'll see some motivations today. But after that, we'll forget data. It'll all be just mathematical vectors and vector spaces and so on. But it has connections to data. I'll motivate that. So the first part of the first lecture will be atypical because we're going to give motivations and sort of connections to real world things. Most of the time, we'll move on and just prove things mathematically, right? It's foundation, so I'm not going to tell you necessarily particular models, particular situations. Occasionally, I will give you examples like I'll do now, but generally I won't. Generally it'll be abstract, right? There are two aspects. One is algorithms, are known as models, stochastic models or deterministic models, algorithms and tools. You'll see both of these. This follows a book, and I meant to give the reference, but so it's a book I'm writing with Avram Blum and John Hopcroft, called Foundations of Data Science, and you can download it from Hopcroft's website, right? And what we are going to do in these lectures are chapters 2 and 3. And I'll stress this as we go along. The prerequisites, of course, you are all familiar with linear algebra, multivariate calculus, probability, basic probability, right? I will assume that, and I'll stress that as I go along, right? Okay, so with that, I'll move on. As I said, the first part of the first lecture is atypical. I'm going to give you motivations. Okay, so for this course, each data point is in real space, d-dimensional real space. I'll always use d for dimension, where d is large. Now, you can, there are quibbles about this. Now, the reason for this is, in fact, I'll give you an example. In many modern applications, the d is a number of features. Each coordinate is a feature, and each data point has one component for each feature and tells you the importance or the weight of that feature, right? So if you have images, they are represented, for instance, and then we'll see how documents are represented in this way. Now, you can say this is not universal. Sometimes coordinates are Boolean or some things like that. Yes, that's true, but most of the time they're real. In this course, we'll deal with real vectors. Also, there's much nicer mathematics to do with real vectors that I can easily understand than other things. So we'll just do that in this course. For us then, data points are just points in RD. Okay. There are two broad things you can look at. One is the modeling part. I mentioned this sort of. Modeling part, what features should be used, what should be the value of each feature value. So we'll see in a minute, example of representing documents by vectors. And when you represent documents by vectors, each component maybe the frequency of one particular word. Component corresponds to a word and the frequency. Maybe frequency is not the right thing. You should take the square root of the frequency or the log. These are the kinds of details we won't worry about here, right? But somebody who does the modeling has to worry about to get a good model. So we assume that it's their job. They've done the modeling and given us points in RD, right? That's what we'll do here. And the second part is understanding and processing data, mathematical structure, properties of data, and so on, as well as algorithms, right? So course mainly deals with the second part, with occasional examples, as I'm going to now describe. Right at this point, I'm going to describe some examples of modeling, right? Okay, so example one, which is a fairly standard example. So if you have a collection of documents, I want to represent them. Represent each document as a point in D space, where D is large, right? So let's say the documents use a vocabulary of D words or terms. Every word may not make it to your list of terms. I mean, articles may be omitted and, you know, and things like that. This kind of pruning the modeler does. You don't worry about it. It's given to us after all the pruning is done. And we represent each document as a D vector, D-dimensional vector, which lists the frequency of each term in a document. Or it may be the square root of the frequency or whatever, but it's some function of the frequency usually. I guess this was supposed to be an example. So here's a random document. These words occur, I mean, these words occur with very high frequency, right? And so you know what the document is. Now, I mean, one question is, right, we completely forgot the context. We didn't worry about which words occur next to which words, right? So we don't worry about that. This is called the bag of words representation. Even though it throws away a lot of information, it's turned out to be quite useful and used in a lot of applications. Now, if you want to worry about neighboring words, you could worry about pairs of words and their frequencies. Pairs of words occurring next to each other. So bigrams, they're called, and their frequencies. So you could do things like that. Those are tweaks to the model, but this is just an example to say documents are represented as vectors. Okay. One more example, which also is crucial. So if you have a collection of DURLs, if you want to describe the whole web, let's say all the URLs are there, D of them. The D is very large, right? Billions. Each URL, I'm going to say, becomes a D vector with 0, 1 coordinates, right? And the 0, 1 is 1 in position I. If there's a hypertext link, so one particular URL I'm looking at has become a vector. And the vector's ith component is 1 if there's a link from that URL to your URL to the ith URL in the collection, 0 otherwise, 0, 1 vectors, right? Of course, there's a bit of, you don't have to list, this potentially could be D squared elements, right? But of course, most of them are zero. Everybody points to, I don't know, at most 7 URLs on average. So this is very sparse. There are only 7 D non-zeros. You would only list them. But this is the kind of detail we don't worry about at the moment. But there are 7 D rather than D squared ones to list, right? So I suppose most of this went away. So okay, so you may ask, so far I've said, take documents or take URLs, plunk them down as vectors. That seems actually a trivial exercise. All I've done is made a list of things. I could have made a list or a linked list or any other data structure. So you can say, what's the point of calling them vectors? Okay, there turns out to be a point. It's not obvious immediately. There turns out to be a point that, for instance, correlation between URLs. So this is URL 4 and 5. I want to know how many URLs do they both point to? How many common pointers are there from these URLs? As you know, for 0, 1 vectors, that's just a dot product. But dot product of vectors turns out to be more prevalent, more useful measure of correlations between data points. So one reason for listing them as vectors is perhaps you can do things like dot product, right? Instead of having a linked list or something. So the vector thing is useful. Now, not only dot products, but it turns out orthogonality and everything is quite useful. Angles, linear algebra quantities, orthogonality is very useful. Also, principal components, which I will define in a minute and will be covered in the second part of the course, will also turn out to be very useful in a lot of applications. So this is not just a bookkeeping exercise to put them down as vectors instead of linked list or stack or something like that, right? So it's not just a pointless exercise. So I will soon say something controversial so you can have questions, right? I should think of that. Okay, so high dimensional geometry. So far what we have seen that data can be represented usefully, if you believe me, and we have to still demonstrate that, in very high dimensional space. In this example, D is in the billions, right? So it's still feasible because it's sparse, but it's in the billions. So we have seen that. So it will be nice to see what billion dimensional space, what vectors in billion dimensional space look like, right? That will be the first 2 weeks of the course, of this mini course, right? To see some properties of high dimensional geometry. So since data consists of points in high-dimensional space, it's important to understand properties of high-dimensional space. And these are quite different from two and three dimensions. And that's what I want to communicate in these lectures. Before I go on, I want to say there'll be two things that will hopefully, or the highlights of these 2 weeks. One is called the Johnson-Linden-Strauss random projection lemma. which I won't define now, but random projection theorem. But if you like, you can look it up. And the second highlight will be, so how many of you know Chernoff bounds? Okay, good. I mean, we will see them. So the second one will be, you have things like Chernoff bounds for 0, 1 random variables. So Bernoulli random variables. You can prove similar results. What they are, when I come to it, I'll tell you in detail. But for right now, I just want to pick your curiosity a little bit and have you look up things if you want to, right? Chernoff bounds, 0, 1 random variables. Now, I could instead take sums of Gaussian random variables. And I could take sums of squares of Gaussians. These all come up. So what's meant here is I have x1 through xn, which are IID, and xi is normal 0, 1. If this notation is not familiar, this is not the right course for you, right? I mean, all of this should be very, very familiar. IID is identical independently distributed, right? So, and in this case, you take the sum of squares, and in that case, you just take their sum. Or you could take sum of exponentially distributed random variables. So the second highlight of these lectures will be one result from which you can derive concentration properties of all of these. So these are all useful, and in practice, you have different proofs that the sums of these things behave or very close to their expected value, right? So when you take the sum of a bunch of random variables, their sum will be close to the expected value. That's, again, I'll put up things you should know, central limit theorem and large numbers, law of large numbers you should know, and if not, revise them. They tell you that, but usually the proofs are all different. So one thing you might want to think about at home is what common thing can derive all of these, and we'll see one, right? We'll see a theorem that tells us how to derive all these concentrations. So I'm giving you the highlights partly to tell you what the course is, but partly also so you can go and revise up, brush up your old linear algebra and probability, right? Okay, so volumes and surface areas are just integrals, and so we can work them out in 3D. We can also work them out in any number of dimensions. So 3D is multiple integration, three integrals. Instead, you will have D integrals now, right? Now, here are some simple facts, right? The volume of a cube of side one in D dimensions is still one, okay? That's good. This is the cube, right? So the volume is one. What's the volume of a cube of side two? So if you scale up each side by two in three dimensions, you scale the volume by eight, right? In two dimensions by four, in three dimensions by eight, and so on. In D dimensions, you scale it up by two to the D, because every dimension scales up by two. Good thing to remember. What about the d-dimensional sphere? Also the same. If I up the radius by a factor of 2, I up the volume by a factor of 2 to the d. Okay. These are all follows by integration. So the fact to remember is, so you're going to be integrating to do this. So you have an infinitesimal cube in d. This is three-dimensional, right? And if I expand each side by a factor of 2, the volume goes up, I mean, I can't draw that, but volume goes up by a factor of 8, right? That's all I'm saying. So once you have this property for a cube, it's true for everything else, like a sphere, right? This follows from that. Why is that? Because in getting the volume of this, you'll be integrating. Okay, maybe I should just tell you why that is maybe in a picture. I won't actually prove this. So here's a sphere of radius 2. Here's a sphere of radius 1. I integrated the volume of this by taking cubes here. And corresponding to each cube, there's a cube of side double the side, right? So I got this bigger one by going along every infinitesimal cone and doubling the side, doubling each point. So we'll see the volume just goes up by a factor of 2 to the d because it does so for a cube, therefore for everybody. Okay, so here's a nice picture that I like to put up. So things don't really look like this, but this is a picture to remember. So here's a cube of site one, centered at the origin, right? And in two dimensions. And here is a sphere in two dimensions, just a circle of radius also one, right? And clearly that encloses the square in two dimensions. In three dimensions, I mean, the cube doesn't quite look like this, but we have drawn it like this schematically, right? In three dimensions, it's exactly touching, right? Is that right? Let's see. So this cube of is side one, side one. So you have a half here. So you get 3/4. Well, you should be able to. I'm trying to work out the distance of the corner. So if you have the origin here, half to each side, a vector of all halves, this distance is what? Is 1 over 4, the Pythagoras theorem, right? D root D over 2. Root of the dimension over 2. I think this is 4 dimensions. So now we worked out there. So the legend is meaning, well, this is illustration radius 1 in 4. This is 4 dimensions, right? In 4 dimensions, the corners would be exactly on the sphere. Everybody with me? I'm just doing Pythagoras. When you go to d dimensions, you get root d over t. D is big, so this is enormously outside the ball, right? The corners of the cube are way outside the unit ball. Unit sphere is radius 1. This distance is root d over t. That's all I'm trying to say here. The cube is, of course, convex, so this picture is not correct. You know, this it cannot be that the line is out. It's a convex set. But it's just drawn like that because the centers of the faces are inside, right? So the center of one of the faces is distance half, but the corners are way out. Okay. So as you go to lower dimensional faces, they are very far out. Okay. Again, nothing profound so far. Okay. So we will, okay. I'm sorry, I should stress this. The course will prove these kinds of statements properly. We'll compute the volume of the sphere and things like that properly. But you might want to do this at home. You certainly want to review your multivariate calculus, right? I mean, if it's not fresh on your fingertips, please review it. Also, try to prove that the volume of the d-dimensional sphere goes to zero as d goes to infinity. Okay? So instead of multiple integration with three integrals, you will get, if d is 10, you get 10 integrals, right? And if you work out the volume properly, I won't do this. I'm going to do the volume in a different way. If you work out properly, you'll get powers of trigonometric functions, right? You have to integrate d powers of sine and cosine, and you have to use multiple angle formulas from trigonometry to do the integral. That's a good exercise, perhaps, to do, just to review your calculus. Okay. And then we'll see that. So this picture is trying to indicate that, because this big thing is a cube of side one, and it's much bigger in a lot of ways than the sphere. The cube of side one has volume one. This is going to be much smaller, going to zero. We'll prove that. We'll prove that differently. We'll prove that in a nicer way than multiple integration by relating it to Gaussians. So in fact, I want to use that to bring in Gaussians and the connection to spheres. But you should try to prove it sort of in an elementary way. So see if you can do that. OK. The next 2 weeks, a very brief intro to basically singular value decomposition, principal component analysis. They go by both these names. I'll tell you what it is right now, but in the last 2 weeks of the course, we'll see that. So so many of you know principal component analysis, but perhaps you've seen it slightly differently from what I'm going to tell you now. It's the same thing, but I'm going to tell you in a particular way which perhaps is more is simpler, more elementary, also more to do with data. So the principal components are just best fit directions of a set of vectors. So I give you this set of vectors. That's your data, bunch of vectors, bunch of data points. Take the best fit line, namely the line, the red line. Okay. I define best fit by saying I take the sum of squared perpendicular distances of these vectors to that line, to that infinite line. So here I've drawn the perpendicular things. I don't take just the perpendicular, I take the sum of squares, because you've all seen least squares, right? It's very similar to least squares, except it's not exactly least squares, because least squares does vertical distances, right? So what does your calculus least squares do? So you have a bunch of points, and you fit a line to it, right? Now, typically, you take the vertical distances, square them and sum, right? Now I'm telling you to take the distance perpendicular to the line. So it's slightly different. Okay? And the reason for taking sum of squares is it has many nice mathematical properties. Just as in your calculus least squares, if instead I took sum of distances instead of squaring them, if I took these distances, that becomes much more difficult. We've learned in calculus how to do least squares, right? Because it's a sum of squares, the derivative is linear and it's very nice. So we do that, right? For the very same reason or very similar reason, here also taking the sum of squares is very important. So in linear algebra, you always take squares, right? Sum of squares of vectors, sum of squares of distances, so squares are important. Just like least squares, there will be an algorithm to do this. We'll see that, but this is the best fit line. It's called the first principal component. Okay, there are other principal components. So the best fit direction, the first thing is V1 is the first principal component. Then you take the best fit direction V2 perpendicular to V1. That's called the second principal component, right? And so on. So V3 perpendicular to both of these. The best fit direction, best fit meaning sum of squares, sum of squared distances, right? And finding k such directions gives you the k principal components. And a lot of algorithms do the following. They find the first k principal directions and project all data to the space spanned by these. So somehow these are considered the very important directions, right? And it turns out in a lot of applications that's true. Again, I'm not telling you all the details. This is just a peep into what we'll do in those lectures. Okay, and then algorithms do something in the projection, but the idea is to find these. Okay, so we'll spend the second part doing that. Any questions so far? I've been fairly general, so presumably this is just, actually, as I said, an overview of what's going to happen. I'm going to do one or two detailed things today, probably the simplest things, and then we'll finish. Okay, probability in high dimensional geometry. So please review your and be current on your basic probability. You should know what random variables, mean, variance, independence, and so on are. You should know the statement of the central limit theorem. You don't necessarily have to know the proof right now, but it'll be nice if you know the proof, but we won't. I don't insist on that, at least the statement. You should know what the variance covariance matrix is. You should know what a multivariate Gaussian density is, probability density, right? Not just spherical Gaussian, but general multivariate probability density is the dimension. All of these, if you're not familiar, look up. Okay, so from probability, as I said, if a data quantity is average of many independent quantities, it behaves like the like a Gaussian random variable, the central limit theorem, right? So many analogies between vectors of D independent random variables and points from D dimensional space. Okay, so I said geometry so far and I suddenly brought in probability. I did so because this is true, that there are many analogies between vectors in very high dimensional space and sums of many random variables. Okay, and we'll see one or two of those analogies. So if this is just saying that Gaussian random variables is a particular case of that. So this is true for independent Gaussian random variables. Okay. We'll prove also that if you have a random point from a D-dimensional hypersphere centered at the origin, then the sum is nearly zero. So I'm going to draw a picture, which we will see. So I'm going to draw two pictures for you. So one is a sphere in d dimensions. If I take the sphere, this is d. Most of the mass of it is near the equator. So this is the equator. So this has 1 minus epsilon of the volume. So I haven't told you the width of this annulus is very small. It's going to zero as d goes to infinity. So I guess anybody who hasn't seen it, if you want to guess how wide this annulus is, that'll be interesting. How wide will it be? As a function of d, right? If you've seen it, you shouldn't guess it. Anybody wants to guess? Another way of saying that is, if I pick a random point from the sphere, it's highly likely to be close to the equator. By the way, what is the equator? What is this region? This is the region set of x, let's say, so that x1 is small. I mean, if the north pole is when x1 is 1, then this is the equator. I could have called any axis anything the north pole, but I'm calling the first axis, so then x1 is less than or equal to delta. So how large or how small is delta so that I capture quite a lot of the volume? We'll see that. Still no random guesses? Okay, it's good. I mean, you're not going to be that brave. That's fine. So we'll show this. We'll also show, and the second thing will be easier. This is one. The second fact will be another picture, which will be easier. So this is also in d dimensions. And in fact, most of the volume will be in this part. So this one minus epsilon also applies to something very near the boundary, right? So most of the volume will be there. We'll prove this today and this the next time, or maybe both if there's time. Yeah. But I want you to think about why these are not contradictory. Okay? So I'm asserting two things, right? I'm saying 99% of the volume is here. I'm also saying 99% of the volume is here. So is that make 198% or what happens, right? It'll be good for you to think about that. We will think about that. So everybody at least got the facts. So, I mean, I have to tell you the widths of these annulus. Yeah? Oh, the second picture is again a sphere of radius 1, right? And I take, let's say, I make this 1 minus delta. I used a delta already. Let me put delta prime. So, and I'm left with all points within delta prime of the boundary. No, this is both of them are d-dimensional. Which one is? This. I mean, if I draw a flat like that, there'll be d minus 1 dimensional. It's uniform over the entire ball. Okay. It's uniform over the interior as well as this, you know, everything. The picture I mean to draw is these are all pictures of x absolute, I mean, the magnitude of x less than or equal to 1. So this is generally true for many. In fact, we'll prove it in general that this is general. And again, we'll state this carefully and prove that. Okay, so again, review and be current on probability. This is the equator thing, which is the first picture on top. So this is lecture 1, so I'm going to lecture 2. Actually, so I, given that this is a very large audience, so you have to figure out for the first lecture what's the fraction of people you want to come back, right? It could be greater than 1 or less than 1, but in this case maybe less than 1. So we'll see. We'll go fast enough for that. Okay. So the first, the second fact. This thing is simpler. I'll prove this right now, and possibly also at this rate, the second fact. Right. So we'll state a theorem properly, but the gist of it is most of the volume of any high-dimensional object is near the surface. So this picture is more general. So I'm taking a cross-section and a thickness. So it's a full dimensional. So the equator is D minus one dimensional, right? So the Earth's equator is a plane. So the equator is one dimension less. But I'm taking the slab, right? I'm taking the set of x such that x1 is less than or equal to delta, not equal to zero alone. Yeah? Is that clear? So this is the equator, real equator. I'm taking everybody within, basically everybody within distance delta of it. No, we will define delta and delta prime in a minute, but still it seems contradictory that I should be putting 99% of the marks here as well as here. Okay, so question is why is, they're both true. We'll prove both. Okay, so the question will be why is it that they're both true? That does imply that most of the mass is in the intersection, correct. So 98% at least, right? If 99% is in this and 99% is in this, their intersection must have at least 98%. Yes. So that seems also not intuitive. And this is where our higher dimensions will differ, right? Intuitively, in three dimensions, if I take a little slab here and a periphery, their intersection is very small, it looks like. So that's wrong in D dimensions. It should be 98% because of these two statements. So this is the second thing that's counterintuitive. The cube and the sphere interaction is perhaps also counterintuitive. Absolutely. On the value d and delta. So the 99% depends on d and delta. Okay. So those three things are related, right? What percentage is there and d and delta. Is a great circle, no. Oh, okay, no, in three dimensions, the great circle would have been one dimensional, right? So I mean to say equator by equator, the two dimensional equator. I mean, if you cut through the earth, which you won't do, yeah, but. So maybe I could have taken that as the equator if my North Pole was there, right? I could have put the North Pole anywhere.
So I'm specifying
one thing. So, okay, that is a good question because that raises another contradiction. This is true of every equator, right? I can put the North Pole anywhere. They all lead to equators. And every one of those is symmetric, and they are saying they are all 99%. That's even more worrisome, right? Things are getting worse, right? So at least for the periphery, there's only one periphery, right? Only one set of points that are within delta prime of the boundary. But for the equator, there are infinitely many, because any point could have been the North Pole. So now we are saying something even worse, that every one of those is 99%. It's also true. All of these are true. This is a volume of a d-dimensional object. So let's see. Let's go through all that, right? So if you have the Earth, right, the usual equator is just a one-dimensional thing. It's a line. It's a line through, right? But I mean to call the equator the two-dimensional planar cut as if we cut the whole Earth into two, right? So in d-dimensions, that planar that cut would have been d minus one dimensional. But now I'm taking a slab, so it's d dimensional. What you're saying is just a line like we usually think of the equator is d minus two dimensional. Yeah? So it is nice to keep track of the number of dimensions because, for instance, volumes scale up by r to the d in d dimensions. But if I want to do the same thing about curves, it's d minus one. So you have to really keep track of the dimensions. So most volume near the surface, let's prove this. This is simple, much simpler than the equator thing, right? So take any object which is finite non-zero volume in d-dimensional space. Okay. I want to argue that if I shrink A by a small epsilon, it shrinks the volume by a lot in high dimensions, right? Small shrinkage shrinks the volume a lot. That is somehow intuitively going to say this, right? If I take this unit sphere and shrink it just by a little bit, by delta prime, I'm saying I've lost most of the volume. Right? My volume has shrunk an enormous amount, right? That's what I want to say. Okay. So we'll denote the the object obtained by shrinking A by epsilon. We call that 1 minus epsilon times A. So this is a scalar. This is a set of vectors, right? It's an object in d-dimensional space, which is a set of vectors. What this means is I take every vector and multiply by a scalar, 1 minus epsilon. So every coordinate is multiplied by 1 minus epsilon. So that's my shrunk object, 1 minus epsilon A. Okay. So what's the volume of 1 minus epsilon times A in terms of the volume of A? I want to know that, right? So if we shrink objects in two dimensions by a factor of two, that's by a factor of half, sorry, multiplied by a factor of half, then in two dimensions, it'd be 1/4 the area would shrink, right? In three dimensions, 1/8, and so on. And for general D, let's see, did I finish? For general D, we again divide space into infinitesimal cubes to integrate of psi dx and count how many cubes are there in this. And you can just imagine each cube being shrunk now. So maybe another picture. So for the sphere, it's clear if I take every point multiplied by 1 minus delta prime, the set of points I get is this. So, you know, if I had a cell, you have some object A, and I want to take everybody and multiply it by 1 minus epsilon. An interesting picture is when the origin is somewhere outside the, this is the origin, right? So what am I doing? I'm taking each point x and replacing it with a point 1 minus epsilon times x, which is on the same line. Okay. And I take everybody like that, then the picture will become something like the same thing. The origin, maybe still outside. In fact, it will still be outside, right? If the origin didn't belong to the A, it will not still belong to this, because I've shrunk every point by 1 minus epsilon. Okay. So the volume of this I would have computed by taking small infinitesimal cubes. I'm doing these pictures. I mean, clearly you know from multivariate calculus all of this. But I want to go over them once at least so that when we go to d-dimensions you can't draw the picture, but at least you can imagine what happens. So you take this and you shrink it by a factor 1 minus epsilon, then it'll become a cube somewhere else. It may not be in the original object, right? If I shrunk it, some of these cubes, the shrunk thing will be outside. But we don't care. It's that cube. Now, this object is made up of cubes like that. It's 1-to-1. You have to convince yourself, for the integral to be correct, you have to convince yourself that it's 1-to-1. It's not completely obvious, right? Because the origin is outside and you're shrinking. It may go outside. But it's still true that every cube goes to a shrunken cube, and every shrunken cube came from one cube. Okay. Again, in 3D, you can imagine these pictures, but it's also true in higher dimensions. If you take any cube, and I do this 1 minus epsilon thing, it'll still be a cube, even if the origin is not the center. So, this is a good point. You know, you should convince yourself that that's true. Cubes shrink to cubes. Okay, that's important. Otherwise, all I'm saying is not going to be true, right? That's right. Distance will be maintained, or another way to say it is a cube says that x1 minus the center is at most 1 in absolute value. If I shrink it, x1 minus the new center is also shrunk, will be at most 1 minus epsilon, right? So that's, you have to prove that cubes go to cubes for these statements to be true. But they do. Okay, good. So we divide space into infinitesimal cubes and see how many cubes are inside. And there's a 1-to-1, okay, so this is what you're asking. 1-to-1 corresponds to cubes of side, and cubes of side 1 minus epsilon dx contained in this. Draw a picture on the board. Okay. So the tech would have cost me a lot of time to draw, so that tech, so I did just. Okay. So volume of the d-dimensional cube of side, that is, you've shrunk d sides by 1 minus epsilon factor, so you multiply the volume by a factor 1 minus epsilon to the d. Therefore, we get a lemma, which we approved now, right? Because of these integrals, that the volume of 1 minus epsilon times a is at most 1 minus epsilon to the d times a. And here's an important inequality you should remember throughout the course. 1 minus x is always less than or equal to e to the x for all real x. This is probably the most used inequality in this course or any other course, right? But it's true for x, negative, positive, everything. Okay? It's always true. Therefore, this one, it gives you this factor. What does this tell you? The most important thing here is d is an exponent, right? So if epsilon is 1 over d, already it starts falling. If epsilon is 10 over d, you get e to the minus 10, right? So it's a very small fraction. So this delta prime is order 1 over d. So in 1,000 dimensions, most of the volume is within 1,000th of the surface, 1 over d. Okay. So that's the width of the annulus. We will later also want to find the width of such annuli for Gaussians. And for Gaussians, the width is 1 over root d. It won't be the same. So if I pick n Gaussians, right, and plot them as points, sorry, d Gaussians, plot them as points in d-dimensional space, there will be an annulus, but of width 1 over root d, so that most of the probability mass lies there. We'll prove that. But it's still an annulus. So what I'm now saying is this delta prime depends on the object. Okay. For the sphere, it's 1 over d. For Gaussians, it'll be 1 over root d. For various other objects, it'll be different. For cubes, also, it'll be 1 over d. I didn't prove that, but that's something you should prove. The other way inequality. Yes. So this was exact, right? This was exact. Good point. So the volume of 1 minus epsilon times a is exactly equal to 1 minus epsilon to the d volume of a. Right? No loss there. Only when I went to e to the minus epsilon d, I lost something. Okay, specializing to the sphere, we get a slightly better statement. I mean, the statement that we wanted, all but e to the minus epsilon d of the volume of the unit hypersphere lies within distance epsilon of the surface. Okay. Why is that? Because every point at distance at most delta prime from the surface is in the annulus, and vice versa. The annulus here consists precisely of the set of points within distance delta prime of the boundary, right? That's just for the sphere, that's true. That's not necessarily true for everything. Right? For the cube, if I shrunk it by a factor of 1 minus epsilon, but I draw only so you do get a square, right? But this is not the set of points at distance at most epsilon from the boundary. That set is different. That set is sort of a little bit rounded near the boundary. Okay, so that proves what we want, the volume near the boundary. Yeah? Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, yeah, I called it epsilon here. Yeah, they're the same. So if somebody told you that data points were uniform random from a sphere, if you have a lot of data points, most of them will have sum of squares nearly 1, right? There'll be almost nothing near the origin. All of this is empty space. Okay, there'll be nothing near the origin. It's also true of Gaussians. We'll see that if I pick x1 through xd, iid Gaussians, there'll be almost no probability mass near the origin. The sum will not be nearly zero most of the time. I'm sorry, sum of squares will not be nearly zero most of the time. Sum will be nearly zero. Sum of squares won't be. But what about a sphere of radius r? No, it just all scales by r to the d, right? Nothing new or interesting happens. So that's that picture. Annulus of width 1 over d, everything, essentially, lots, everything lies there. I mean, not everything. So the tightness is the difference between 1 minus epsilon to the d and e to the minus epsilon d, you mean all. This is exact, right? I didn't lose anything. So it's, you know, it's exactly equal to 1 minus epsilon to the d times the volume of this. So if d is 1,000, there's a power of 1,000. If you consider an arbitrary object, what happens? Okay, that's a good question. So for very bad shaped objects, things are not so easy to say. So if I take a cube, it'll still be a cube. It'll be reasonably nice, right? So this is of side, this is half, let's say. This will be half times 1 minus epsilon. It's not, this corner will be still fairly far from the corner, right? The middle of the face will be epsilon distance, but this is epsilon times root d. There's always the root d factor coming in, right? But if you take a long, skinny object like that and take 1 minus epsilon of that, then that'll cut off somewhere very far from that. And we have to work it out for every object. But for bad shaped objects, the volume is still 1 minus epsilon to the d. That's exact. But the distance will be a lot from the corners. Because only for cubes and spheres do volumes behave more or less like distance to the dth power. For odd-shaped objects, no. Right. So here the volume is this dimension, which is very small, times the other dimensions, which are much bigger. So the linear transformations don't preserve lengths. They preserve volumes. Yeah. There are many examples, like the URL example, where the vectors came from a real-world application which had only 0, 1 vectors, right? But once we make them points in D space, we forget combinatorial properties like 0, 1, and only look upon them as real points, and then we can shrink them, expand them, anything. So all of that is interesting. Okay? A much more striking example of this, which is not going to be in this course, where you make vectors which don't, you make points, data into vectors where it doesn't seem to mean anything, is optimization. So you all know the traveling salesman problem, right? Where you have tours through cities and you want to find the minimum length tour. If you don't know it, don't worry because there's not time to explain it. But it turns out the way to solve this, the most common way to solve this problem is to make each tour into a 0-1 vector, which tells you which edges you take, okay? And you take those 0, 1 vectors, put them down in that high dimensional space, and you consider the polytope, and you optimize over this polytope. That turns out to be the best way. One way of optimizing over polytopes is going through the interior to the optimal point. These are called interior point methods. In the interior, you will have absolutely non-0, 1 vectors, right? So even though the combinatorially original problem was only 0, 1, going to real geometry space without with everything, real vectors, turns out to be very useful. And that's so for also the URLs and all these examples. But optimization we won't see in this course, right? That's a completely different context in which you turn data into vectors and then forget about data. It's just vectors that you deal with. Okay, we have come to the end of the hour.